Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends for doctors in women's health. I'm Lindsay Carr, the Associate Editor for Contemporary OBGYN. You'll hear from me as well as my Senior Editor, Angie DeRosa.
And we are here today with Dr. Sarah Daughters-Katz, who is a maternal fetal medicine specialist at Duke Health in Durham, North Carolina. Your research area is clinical infectious diseases and how they impact pregnancy. So we would like to hear from you about the impact of COVID-19.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. You know, the impact of coronavirus on pregnancy is really an interesting one, and it's been fun to watch the story evolve. And I really want to be transparent. I think it's still evolving. As we learn new things about the virus and how it impacts all sorts of people, including women. But what we know right now, I think, is overall very reassuring, both from what we've seen in the published literature and what I can speak to about kind of our experience in Durham, is that many of our patients, many of the women that we see get the virus and do really well. I mean, they, you know, as Dr. Riley noted last week, you feel crummy. It's a bad virus. And when you're pregnant, a lot of women don't feel awesome anyway. So the sort of interplay between kind of not always feeling awesome and then getting a makes you feel crummy. But, you know, we have a really cool outpatient clinic where we're managing all of our moms that have developed coronavirus. They've all done really well. Uh-huh. None of them have needed to be hospitalized, and they've sort of continuing on in their pregnancies.
Okay. And doing really well in their pregnancies, do you get a lot of anxiety among your patients?
Yes, I think one of the most challenging jobs for obstetricians right now included is not only managing the anxiety and kind of helping to support our women who have the virus, but also helping to take care of women who don't have the virus, but who are really, really worried about what this means for them if they were to get it, or how is their pregnant labor going to look different because of the landscape that we're living in right now.
And
I think... No, go ahead.
You and Dr. Hughes had really talked about this as the pathogen that will define the decade.
Yeah.
And can you go more into detail about what exactly you meant by that?
Yeah, of course. I think for everyone, we live differently. Our lives day to day are affected in a way that we could have never imagined, you know, 4 or 5 months ago.
Yes.
Simple things like you wear a mask everywhere you go. And when you meet people, you only see, you know, this much of their face. You don't, you know, for a physician, what we're taught very early on in med school is you go into a room and you shake someone's hand. It is so hard to not shake my patients' hands when I meet them for the first time. I am an emoter, and I like to physically connect with my patients, and to not be able to like touch someone's leg or give them a hug after discussing something really hard, like the way we interact with people, and even just electronically, the amount of interactions that we're having both professionally and with patients through telehealth is totally changing. And so even for people who don't contract the virus, day to day, everything is super different. And for pregnant women, the way they're living their pregnancy is really different.
And when you say the way they're living their pregnancy, you mean in that environment where they're limited, they're...
Right.
Go ahead.
They're connected, limited, their prenatal care, they're having sort of less visits. And some of their visits are happening electronically as opposed to in person, which I don't think is unsafe in any way. I think it's actually probably safer in a lot of places to connect with your doctor this way than it is to go, especially if you live in a city, to take the subway to go to your doctor's office. When you do go to your doctor's office, there are much less people there. Our clinic's doing a very cool sort of telephone check-in. So the patient, instead of coming in and checking in at the front desk, pulls into the parking lot, calls the registration, says, "Hi, I'm so-and-so, this is my date of birth, I'm here." And then we say, "Thank you, you're checked in." And then when they, it's time for their visit, they come in by themselves without a support person, sort of get checked in, get a mask, go directly back to their room. And so their vital signs are all done room, as opposed to kind of moving through our clinic and sort of what I like to call the BC or before COVID era they would have. So I think just a different time to, you know, be experiencing pregnancy, or really just to, you know, be working through our daily life.
And the telehealth component, how have your patients responded to that? Especially in the later stages, I guess, of pregnancy.
Yes. So we are definitely still seeing patients. Right. We're still seeing patients in clinic at the sort of essential points in pregnancy. So for example, at 28 weeks, you need to get some lab work done in every pregnancy. So, and you vaccine. And so those, you know, around 28 weeks, everyone still comes to the clinic. Okay. But often at say like 32, 33 weeks, you don't necessarily need to do anything where you would require an in-person visit. And so a lot of visits at that time are happening via telehealth. And I think patients like it. It's convenient because you don't have to like take off work or get in your car and drive however far to the office. So it's sort of time saving. It's safer. They aren't being worried about being exposed to the other patients in the waiting room, to the healthcare workers, all of those things. And I think as more and more things become virtual and electronic, they're getting much more used to interacting with someone in this way.
And talk to me about any possibility of vertical transmission.
Ooh, that is the million-dollar question.
Okay.
I think right now the evidence that we have is that it's unlikely, but it's possible.
Have you seen it in any of your patients? Are you treating COVID?
So at hospital, we haven't had any women with coronavirus give birth yet. So, you know, the CDC has sort of tempered its language about separating mom and baby after delivery and kind of is recommending that it's done sort of on a case-by-case basis and really giving the mom the information about the risks of transmitting the virus to her baby and what that might look like, and then letting her make the decision if it's best for her and her family. It's sort of like a more harsher kind of like, we must separate mom and so we haven't had a lot of that at Duke University. At some of our kind of community hospitals, we've had a couple patients come through that have tested positive and they've had their babies without issue, and we haven't seen vertical transmission. But I will say that our numbers of women here, and social distancing has been so effective in our community, have actually been pretty low.
And that's what you identified in your recent paper as the most effective social distancing as being the best protective mechanism. And are people adhering to that in your area, or are you seeing a mix?
I think they are. I think a lot of it is forced. Our state, just like many states, has sort of a stay-at-home order. This is a scary virus because you can't see it and so unknown. And the news is powerful and the images are dramatic and they're scary. And so I think that most of the community, as they are able, is really trying to in the most possible, really stay home. You know, you have to go to the grocery store. There's certain things you just have to do, but individuals are really doing their best to stay home as much as possible. And when they do have to go out, minimize those trips, being thoughtful, not taking their whole family, but going by themselves, things like that.
And talk to me about, we know that no herd immunity exists, right? In your opinion, how long would it take before any type of herd immunity?
Gosh, that's a really good question. This virus is pretty infective. And so what I mean by that is that when one person gets it, you know, probably a couple of them are going to get it. And, you know, we know that it's easy. If you're exposed, you're not unlikely to get the virus. I think herd immunity is going to develop faster in places that have a lot of virus. So I feel like in a weird paradoxical way, say for example, individuals in New York City are gonna have herd immunity faster than individuals in Durham, where our prevalence of the disease just isn't very high.
Yeah. And then we wanted to talk about the when it does come to a mother being positive for it, so I guess mother-baby separation.
Yeah.
Avoids transmission. And would you identify that as the most effective and what has to be done?
So I think the issue of mother-baby separation is one of the hardest things that OBGYNs are having to deal with right now.
Okay.
In that, you know, when you have grown a human inside of you, patient has grown this little baby inside of them for 9-10 months. And the first thing that every mom and every family wants to do is snuggle their baby. But we know it's respiratory. So you're putting this little tiny human on your chest and all your respiratory droplets are potentially being transmitted to your baby. And so the good news is, though we've seen neonatal infections, they don't seem to be very severe. And most of the babies have done really, really well and not had a lot of issues.
Okay.
You know, and you can mask mom and be thoughtful and do really good hand hygiene and sort of protect the infant from infection. You know, but again, think about you're breastfeeding every 2 to 3 hours with a newborn. That transmission potential is real. So I think the question of do we separate mom and baby is really a hard one. We know that skin to skin right after delivery is better for mom and baby. We know and often feeding is better for mom and baby, and breastfeeding is the best way to give infants, you know, nutrition. So it's a lot of pros and a lot of cons to each one. And then the other question becomes, even if you separate for 2 days while mom's in the hospital, then they go home together.
Yeah.
And mom's still potentially infectious. And so was all that early separation emotionally traumatic for naught?
Right.
So, you know, I don't think there's a one size fits all answer. I don't think that we know what, you know, I think it's really educating mom, helping her understand the risks, giving her really good tools for masking and hand hygiene, especially when she goes home, and kind of figure out, you know, what makes the most sense for her and her family.
Yes. And that remains. So, you know, I think back, I had my daughter during the swine flu.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
And we did where everybody was everybody was vaccinated in our house. But the fear at that time, having my daughter in October,
right?
I was breastfeeding. What's fascinating is the immunity that I learned about that can be obtained through the breast milk. So yeah. If I got the vaccine, which there's no vaccine available now.
Not yet. No.
Coronavirus, right? So they don't even have that option. Mm-mm. And there's thankfully no evidence of transmission from breast milk.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
And that there is enhanced immunity in babies who are breastfed.
Yes.
And I guess, would there be a way of encouraging, or could you encourage more breastfeeding? Is that even viable?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general as obstetricians, we always encourage breastfeeding as the best mode of feeding for the neonate, independent of the situation in almost all cases. I think my own personal risk profile is different than, you know, other people's. Like, I'm just sort of thinking, gosh, if it was me and it was my baby, I probably would pump breast milk and have someone who wasn't infected give it to my baby, which is an absolutely safe and viable option.
Great.
That's a choice that I would make personally. That might not be a feasible option for other people, but it is a safe option that someone might choose.
Yeah. That's really, really great point. Yeah. To think about. Now here's the fun question that So Dr. Spong, you know, our editor-in-chief, and we've been talking about this here and there. Obstetrics never stops. Babies
Correct. Yes.
Will always be born.
Babies will always be born. Yeah.
What is your perspective of what it's going to look like for all of you in 9 to 12 months?
Believe it or not, this is a hot topic of discussion on labor and delivery. And our what we have decided is that at first we were like, oh gosh, it's going to explode 9 months from now. But actually, when we reflected on it, we thought, gosh, first, get tired of their partner. And like when you're together so much, maybe you're going to have less intercourse. Additionally, with all of the sort of financial complications that are so real for so many families, they may decide like, this is a horrible time to have kids. We're definitely going to use family planning in ways we haven't because it would be, we can't afford another kid. Also, you know, 50% of pregnancies in the United States are unplanned. And those happen as sort of random unions when people are going out and maybe not making the best choices. But if you're really social distancing, those sort of unplanned, sort of spontaneous pregnancies that happen because you're dating or you're out at a party and maybe don't make decisions you might make otherwise aren't really happening because we're all social distancing. And so our thought was that like actually the like boredom babies, if you will, might be evened out by the lack of the sort of other spontaneous pregnancies.
That's very interesting. And I, you know, Dr. Spong said that to me too. She says, and in her editorial for the May issue,
yeah,
you know, that's obstetrics never stops. And that is,
yeah,
to think of it that way is absolutely true. And to see what you guys are seeing and experiencing is very fascinating. But to think of it with those factors that you just mentioned, the, you know, the financial and then the social distancing and what that means for human behavior overall, I guess it's, we don't really know.
Ask again in 9 months.
Are you busier now than in L&D?
So actually it's been really interesting. What we're seeing is more progressive pathology. And so what I mean by that is because I think people are hesitant to come to the hospital because this is where coronavirus is and they're being told to stay home. When they do come, they're a little bit sicker or a little bit further along in labor because they've waited longer than they would be in kind of the normal time. And so we're seeing less visits to our triage, which is sort of like our mini obstetric emergency room, than we normally see. But the patients that we're seeing have more progressed pathology.
And how do you think, so this is another item that Dr. Spong brought up, and it's very interesting. You know, focus on the positive for the OBGYN community right now and take what you learn from this time to carry it forward. What would you say you are learning during this experience, especially with your clinical research interest being infectious diseases? Yeah.
I will say that I continue to be so inspired by the way that our different teams, our outpatient team, our labor and delivery team is working together to create safe ways for women to continue to receive prenatal care and have babies. And it's just sort of, the glass is always half full. Everyone is ready to pitch in. And it's just really an inspiring time to be in healthcare in the setting of something so scary and so potentially dangerous, or really dangerous, seeing all of these individuals working together to do the best we can for our patients right now is just really inspiring.
And do you have, are you satisfied with your PPE?
We are, actually. We've been really fortunate. Our institution has been really thoughtful about how they obtain it, and they actually have developed cool ways to recycle it. And so we actually, I feel very safe when I go to work knowing there is adequate PPE.
And so, and I've heard mixed things.
Yes. Okay. Yes. We are definitely very fortunate and probably in the minority of centers as far as, you know, having enough PPE.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I think I'd love to emphasize to all of the, you know, the listeners that like, this is a really hard and stressful time, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, but especially OBGYN providers, and that you're not alone. We're all going through this. And I think all of our societies are working really hard to put out very thoughtful guidelines about what to do and how to do it. So from a clinical perspective, there's support out there, and that we should all be taking time to be well in ourselves and being able to, you know, do things to keep ourselves healthy so that when we do have to be clinical, you know, we have that energy.
So what are some of the things that you're doing?
So I've been making baby quilts for my pregnant friends and making a pandemic jam.
I've been stress baking. I get it.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. And as I say, thank you so much for the work you're doing out there. You are heroes.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Pap Talk. Don't miss our next episode. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.